In order to, if I might just follow up on that point, in order to know, to be able to mitigate any impact, we need to know what that impact is. And that's why partnering with Airbnb to get that summary data to start off with, protecting the host so that they are not making themselves vulnerable as to whether they got permits or not. At this point, we want to know what they're doing. It seems likely to me, and we'll find out from that survey, these are probably not folks who would be renting out that extra room long-term, that they're doing it on a temporary basis and therefore potentially freeing up. We don't know until we get that information. And so I think that that's why it's particularly important to get that partnership going so that we get that baseline data now. Then we can come back next year with the report that we required in September of 16, which I'm looking at Sandra. Would we also be requiring that report to include this section of multifamily rentals in 2016? So that would be part of that previous motion. That's where we really start grappling with what's happening, what do we need to do about it.
Mr. Miller, my biggest concern about affordability has been that I'm worried that landlords might start jacking up rents across the board because they assume their tenants can make a bunch of money off, you know, renting out their places. And it seems to me that having this 25% cap should actually create a sort of laboratory for us where we can look at whether landlords are jacking up the rents in those units that they are, where they are authorizing short-term rentals. So I'm hoping that's something we can track. And I actually agree with Commissioner Fish. I think that we are rolling the dice, but in my mind, at least, these are dice that could be unrolled. I mean, if we do this for a year or two, and there's a bunch of evidence that actually this is having an effect on affordability across the board, then I'd have no problem saying we should stop this. Now, that still leaves open the question of where do we get the enforcement resources to stop it? But in my mind, we are rolling the dice, but they could be unrolled.
That's a first, Steve.
I'm unrolling.
You've had unringing the bell.
Not sure if I've ever seen that done. But
if I might say something real fast,
sure.
That's being overlooked here is that all the amount of money that's coming in by Airbnb from other areas, those people that come in here and pay for a unit also go out through the local community and pay a tremendous amount of money to those businesses where their gross income will be going up and that tax revenue will be going back into the communities, and we have to factor that in, and you need to look at that because you're not doing a monthly basis, you're going a day by day. The income will be tremendous to this city, and yes, there has to be adjustments on affordable housing taken into considerations, but there will be a tremendous amount more income coming into the local communities.
Lightning, I totally agree with that, and one other piece that I think on your side of the ledger is the compelling testimony we've had from people that have lost their job or had a bump in the road, and
yes.
But for this program, they would be displaced from their apartment and then potentially put at risk of being homeless or housing insecure. So there's that other side of the ledger,
yes.
And I agree with the mayor. We have to look at this holistically. I just want to make sure that we're focused on inventory that's affordable, not what's largely being built by the market right now, which is housing that's market rate, which is great, but it's beyond the reach of a lot of people that are looking for affordable housing.
Fair enough.
Just to put a cap on all that, we'll go ahead and have a conversation with
the
members,
please.
about that, and also we'll talk with Tracy Manning of the Portland
Good.
Housing
yeah,
Bureau
we'd
about
like
how
your,
she might want to measure that.
Yeah, well. Like your counsel about how to do that. So thank you. Welcome.
Hi, good afternoon. I'm Peter Ovington. I've been a resident of Portland for 15 years, and I've lived in the King neighborhood in Northeast in a condominium for about the last 7 years. I support the mayor's proposal and Commissioner Fritz's amendment number one to increase the cap on number of units from 10 to 25%, especially since, again, not all 25% of those units would be home sharing at the same time. So I own a unit in a one-story courtyard condominium building with a total of 12 units. My unit is the end unit, one of two end units. So it's ground floor with obvious visible exits outside for life safety. This past summer, as you were taking up this issue, I delisted my condo from Airbnb to wait and see what the city decides. But when it was listed, I insisted that my guests use my private backyard entrance, and I did this to avoid exposing my neighbors to additional foot traffic through the shared courtyard, so they wouldn't be exposed to folks they don't know. I wanted to mention just quickly the primary residence requirement of 9 months per year. I feel that conversation started at maybe a 6-month requirement, and now it's at 9 months. And now there's talk of changing it to a maximum of 12 days per year that a space could be home shared. So I'm not in favor of something that confining. And then lastly, it's great that the city is taking this up, and I think that's the important first step, but it's homeowners associations that are the real place of next decision making for homeowners like me. There's still that layer, but at least what you're considering here today creates the space for HOAs like mine to have the conversation. So I appreciate it. Thanks.
Good. Thank you very much. Thank you all. Okay, next.
Are these Orion Lumeri and Justin Burry and Gwen Baldwin?
Come on up. I think we've got two or three.
Orion had to step out. So
oh, okay.
If I can try to incorporate some of her testimony into
Please.
Mine, that would be much appreciated. Greetings, city councilors. My name is Justin Burry. I'm the deputy director with the Community Alliance of Tenants, Oregon's only grassroots renters' rights organization, and about 2,000 members strong. And we were grateful to provide the renters' perspective in the mayor's work group over the summer regarding short-term rentals and multifamily housing. And we Portlanders love sharing the city with travelers, and I think we all envision a sharing economy where we can welcome people into our homes with goodwill and warm welcome. What concerns us is that recent trends and new regulations regarding short-term rental housing can hurt the housing stability and affordability of Portland's thousands of tenants. And we worry that short-term rentals seem more beneficial with people with higher and middle incomes, be they hosts or guests, while tenants of low incomes will bear a higher burden of costs and consequences. If equity is the goal for this council, then we must work together to ensure that all Portlanders are protected and thrive. First, we believe that there needs to be a robust effort to educate our community about these new regulations, and we need the funding to do so. We believe that the home sharing platform themselves have a responsibility to have a clear and accessible resource page on their websites, and that also is integrated into the sign-up process for hosts. And I will say that, you know, rarely do you see tenants groups and landlords groups coming together and being on the same page. And this is a group where our group and Gwen's and Deborah's group have really found a lot of common ground on this issue. And so we really want to make sure that the residents and the business owners that are here are supportive of this. And so regarding the enforcement, CAD has been engaged with the neighborhood inspections team for many years and to improve the habitability of rental housing. And we've learned that a purely complaint-based model of code enforcement has challenges and gaps. And we support robust monitoring of short-term rentals, which would include an easy way to match and verify an online profile with the required registration rentals. I do appreciate Commissioner Fish's recommendation that a listing without a number would not be shown. We want there to be funds available for the monitoring of this registration without jeopardizing any funds for enhanced inspections in East Portland, of course. And we also want, you know, fines. I don't see any damages in terms of the proposed legislation. So if there is an out of compliance, what is the fine? What is that a host would have to pay if they are out of compliance? And is that high enough to incentivize people to actually register? And you know, what responsibilities do platforms such as Airbnb have when they're profiting off of rentals that are not actually registered or legal with the city? And there also, when it relates to affordability, there has been much discussion, but very little empirical research or data around the impacts on affordability. And you know, renters face substantial rent increases throughout Portland, especially in amenity-rich neighborhoods like inner neighborhoods, where short-term rentals might be more popular. So it might not be across the whole city, but areas that are undergoing gentrification or have experienced gentrification, will short-term rentals exacerbate that and further segregate our city on kind of racial and socioeconomic lines, because it might be targeted specifically in certain areas and not in others. And so we want to see more data. So the survey sounds good. I haven't seen the survey, but if there was a required survey every couple of years with the hosts to say how else would this unit be occupied, would be really helpful in order for us to see what kind of impacts on the vacancy rate and the affordability might be going forward, and to make sure that that all of there is compliance. I think that the residence requirement is crucial, and so and. But how do we regulate that? It is a really tough question. How do you monitor folks to see if they're there 270 days out of the year and not kind of vacating the unit or just claiming residency is a really important issue. And on the last point, we have received calls from tenants on the renter's rights hotline that have experienced harassment or evictions related to Airbnb and short-term rentals. And so, you know, there are a number of reasons why tenants are harassed and evicted. Because there is, you know, a lack of robust protections. And so this could be adding one more reason for a tenant to face instability and vulnerability to their home. And so we would like to see in the registration process even just kind of a signed statement that's as the host that says, I haven't harassed or evicted a tenant in the last year to prepare this unit for a short-term rental, just so at least they state it and they can be held against it if that was not the case. And so in closing, we do see this as a primarily an equity issue. Portland is an innovative city, which is why Airbnb chose us for our headquarters. But if we can benefit from the innovative new platforms that let us share all the great things we love about our cities, we must also innovate and create good creative policies to protect our most vulnerable. We must share better. Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks very much. Ms. Baldwin, welcome.
Thank you. Good afternoon, I think. Maybe close to evening. Mayor Hales and commissioners, my name is Gwen Baldwin, and I'm here today on behalf of Multifamily Northwest. Deborah Imsey regrets she was not able to be here today, but she was called away. As we testified in July when council considered short-term rentals on single-family structures, Multifamily Northwest provides a standard lease agreement to its members that prohibits specifically short-term rentals. And so it's clear that council be really clear today, it's part of the education piece, that nothing within this code supersedes or trumps the lease agreement, which I know you've said before, it really bears repeating because it does not often translate beyond these chambers. And obviously, we will also do our part to do that education as well. The base proposal requires notarized signature of the multifamily owner on the permit application, and we strongly support this aspect of it. And we appreciate the fact that it's being added to the single-family rentals, which was not the case when that piece was considered this summer. But it's really, really critical that any notarized signature is checked against the owner of record for the property. As was noted earlier, notarization simply says that the person is the one with the ID, not that they have any relationship or bearing to the property necessarily. It's also critical that BDS confirms that any signature on behalf of an LLC or other partnerships with multiple owners is from the member with authority to enter into obligations. That is not everybody. So we are not actually supportive of the amendment that would allow property managers to act on behalf of an owner. As property management staff vary widely in terms of their training and authority to act on behalf of the owner. If you're looking for an alternative for an out-of-state or something of that, or multi-owner, authorized agent is the right term to use. That way, the signature has to be able to attest that they are the authorized agent to serve as an alternative. An on-site property manager is not at all capable of doing that. We do support the amendment to require that owners or property managers certify their functioning interconnected carbon monoxide and smoke detectors in the unit. This is an area where the property manager is trained to be able to certify that. And those rules are so important. They're governed by state law. We, as the owners, are responsible under state law for that. And in fact, one of the biggest problems we have in multifamily housing is residents who may tamper or disable smoke detectors and carbon monoxide detectors. And so this way we can be doubly sure that everything is functioning, and that protects everybody, especially other residents in the building. We are not able to support the raising of the cap. And we appreciate the thinking into this and the consideration of the sort of the math. But we do think that there is exposure to an owner around the triggering of the R1 rules. There are one bedrooms where the owner, where the host does pull up, use the pull-out couch. I have friends who, in fact, are such owners. There are folks who have two bedrooms, and they do consistently use that second bedroom to rent out under Airbnb. And I think that 25% puts at risk whether this is truly an accessory use. And that was, you know, the issue that we just have been discussing for months. But, again, if there was a way to have further conversation about this, we are always willing to have further conversation. And finally, there, to echo Justin's point, there's nothing in this proposal that compels the resident or operator or hosting platform to have the permit actually get pulled and completed. The only direct impact to a permit holder from a code violation where the permit holder didn't, for example, get a permit, is that they're not allowed to get a permit for 2 years. And that doesn't seem like much of an impact to that person. And in fact, the only penalty within current code is applied to the property owner. So that code and allows, any kind of code, allows for the owner to have a lien or a fine placed against the property. So the city, not intentionally, but effectively, is forcing the property owners to use their lease agreement and eviction notices as the only enforcement for residents' noncompliance with the city permit. And it seems like there really has to be a better way to consider and adopt meaningful enforcement mechanisms that will directly engage the permit holder or the hosting platform in getting those permits done.
Ms. Baldwin, I think that's absolutely right. And I don't know if we could do it today, but I think that we need to take steps to ensure that, I mean, if it's the renter that is the host, then if they're not doing things wrong, a penalty should apply to them. So that's definitely something we're not going to forget.
Thank you.
Gwen, we had a couple of questions that came up during the hearing, and you're the closest thing we have to an expert on the multifamily side. So if you don't mind,
hey,
let me throw a few questions at you. And if you don't know, maybe you could get back to us.
Of course.
So one of the questions was about insurance that applies to the guest.
Mm-hmm.
And having once purchased renter's insurance,
mm-hmm,
for an apartment to cover my belongings, I'm somewhat familiar. But what is the legal landscape? What is the insurance that applies if a renter essentially participates in this system and rents out one of their units? Who provides the insurance for the guests?
Well, Commissioner Fitch, that's actually quite uncertain at this point. Most of we do have members of our association who are in the insurance business, and we, you know, affiliates and such. The renter's insurance around property or liability is specific to the renter who pulls that insurance policy. So it would not apply to.
But renter, or I'm assuming it's renter and authorized guest. Or the renter that has someone over for dinner and the person slips in the bathroom, I assume that person's covered.
An Airbnb guest is not the same as a guest under landlord-tenant law.
Okay.
And under current insurance policies. It doesn't mean they wouldn't create. Insurance industry is obviously very nimble. If they see a market, they may very well create one. But the renter's insurance wouldn't necessarily cover a sublet because that's often prohibited not only by the lease but by the terms. And the host guarantee, which Airbnb affords to its hosts, and as you know, I am on a property outside the city limits, a host, and so I read that part with great interest when I was going to be having my property under rent. It also is not clear that that would apply in a multifamily structure or to other residents in a multifamily structure if, for example, an Airbnb guest tipped over a candle and there was damage to that unit and several units nearby, those other renters would not be covered by that host guarantee. They would have to come to a renter's insurance and apply that way.
So this is, to me, this is a fairly important question for which I think we're going to want a little more specificity. If I'm traveling and stay at a Holiday Inn and I have an accident in the bathroom, I bring a claim against Holiday Inn. They may have limits on what my recovery is. There may be things I've signed away when I entered into the agreement, but my assumption is I'm going to be covered by someone.
Mm-hmm.
If I'm a guest presumably, and something happens, and this must happen nationally, there must be some data on this. I'm going to bring a claim against the host. If the host doesn't have insurance or resources, I'm presumably going to go against the landlord.
Mm-hmm.
If the landlord doesn't have anything, I might go against the city, claiming that the city was negligent somehow.
Even if the landlord had insurance, we're reasonably confident it would not apply because this is a sublet situation, and most insurance don't allow for sublets.
So could you follow, ma'am, we'll come back to you in a sec. Could you follow up with us with
happy to.
Something and on that? Because it's an issue that came up. I think it's an important one. Commissioner Novick raised a concern that there may be landlords willing to waive or modify the no sublet or no
yes.
commercial activity or whatever prohibition that's in every standard lease,
mm-hmm.
provided they got either a piece of the action or raised the rent on the renter. Is that a likely is that an option which your members may consider renegotiating the rental agreement to somehow share in the upside?
Again, our standard lease prohibits subletting, commercial activity, and specifically short-term rentals. So, again, it's not anything that any of our members or any other people who use our standard lease are allowing. So it's a little bit of a hypothetical. I would say that if there is additional wear and tear to the unit because of a particular practice, that might warrant some additional increase, but would have to be reasonable and defensible, or else my good friend Justin will be seeing me across the table.
I'd like to address that as well. I mean, what we fear is that landlords would proactively raise the rent and say, hey, look, this is a marketable unit. All you have to do is rent it out this many times a year in order to make this increased amount of rent workable prior to the tenancy. And so they might be building it into their rent from the outset, and then the tenant is in this position of trying to make up for it by maybe going out of their way where they normally wouldn't, to have to make up for it by renting out more than they want to.
I think it's clear we're changing the market for a certain commodity, and we're not quite sure what the impact is. So there's
yes.
a whole bunch of things that we're going to evaluate. Gwen, let me push back for a moment
sure.
on your recommendation that we have an authorized agent.
Mm-hmm.
Because one of the things we're trying to do is get Commissioner Fritz and the Bureau of Development Services out of being the referee in a lot of different aspects here. I understand why your position would be make sure it's an authorized agent, but
mm-hmm.
can't your industry simply educate property managers that they're not authorized to consent unless they go through a process, and doesn't it solve it at your end without putting us in the middle of that?
Commissioner Fish, I don't know that this would put BDS necessarily in the middle of it, other than I would hope they're checking against the owner of record so that someone doesn't say, hi, I'm John Doe and I'm the owner.
But authorized agent,
but authorized agent is simply, I think, a reinforcement on the application to the person who's signing that they have to be. It doesn't require BDS to
I see that I'm
verify.
So it's a line that says
and I am authorized. Yeah.
Okay,
that's just
I'm sorry, because I was reading it more like it's another check that they would have to do.
You're saying it's
just a disclosure.
Yes.
That makes sense.
Okay. Other questions for these folks? Thank you.
I did forget to mention, because it's new, I just learned about it today, we support the 10% cap but not the 25% cap.
Okay. Thank you. Thanks very much. Okay, do we have some other folks that are going to speak?
I show the last three who signed up are Thubton Comerford, Arlene Vila, and Ned Harris.
Are you here?
Mr.
Come on up.
Entwistle wished to
come
speak
on up.
Also.
Yeah, no, I want to call the staff back up on that, a couple of other questions. Come on up. Thank you.
Good afternoon. My name is Stephen Entwistle, Sr., for the record. subsidized public housing. People that are living in subsidized housing right now, a lot of the subsidized housing is not really, I don't even consider it housing. I would consider it temporary shelter. And there's a lot of people that want to get out of that housing. And they're trying to get jobs to get out of that housing. And if the rents are going to, they're already too high for people to get out, they're stuck. And they're only going to go up higher. I see this, and this is not an economic downturn that we live in. This is a depression, especially for those that don't have jobs. Okay. And for those that don't have jobs and they're living in public housing and barely making it, they don't really have a lot of rights. People can just walk over them. Businesses can be noisy all night, and complaints are ignored, and that's a fact. To wait for the federal government to help with homeless issues, when on your watch there's 115 that we know of right now that have jumped off of bridges. But apparently this council and this government here doesn't really talk about that very much. It doesn't worry about it. What I want to do is I want to suggest that the externalities, if I can just give a few more seconds, the externalities that it's going to happen from having all these rental units and all these people coming from different countries of the world, and they got their money and they're going to be spending it all around the city, okay? All the little shops, all the stores, okay? They're going to get influxed with money, with cash, big time, okay? And the more this thing grows, the more that's going to grow. And I think you guys know that. What I would like to see is that the city can do something innovative. Okay, instead of ignoring the homeless issues and the homeless problems, instead of using a hammer to deal with it, okay, why don't we use some of these funds that are going to be subsidizing? We need help in this area, and we're not getting any help. Okay. And I just would like to consider, unless you want to see more people jumping off of bridges the next few years. Okay, this is a real serious issue. I had a friend of mine last night talk to. His brother jumped off a bridge. Okay, he's done. And I've been working with him, trying to counsel with him. And there's others, too, that I can admit. But anyway, I won't take more time. Thank you.
Thank you. Welcome.
Hi, I'm John Brennan. I'm an Airbnb host and guest. I live quite close to the Lion and Rose in the Inner Northeast. I have a 4-unit condo. Has 2 possible rooms in addition to what I, as owner, operator, and resident, are available. One goes to a roommate, and the other is available for my personal guests and for Airbnb guests. So I manage my Airbnb calendar based on my friends coming into town. The condo building does not have a shared opening. Each of the units in the condo have their own address and own separate front door. And I was, the day I got the email from Airbnb, was on the site and quickly saw that I did not comply with the regulations because this issue hadn't been addressed yet. So I don't have a permit for that reason, and would very much like to get one. I don't know what the costs of retrofitting an Edwardian house for the fire alarm tie-in is going to be, but I don't have any statistics in terms of how much I rent and how much I bring in, but I know that that initial retrofit is going to be a sizable percentage of what I bring in every year. The next point I want to address is that even though I'm going through some a financial pinch right now, I am gone 2 to 3 months a year in Portland, seeking better weather during the winter months. And yet, this is my primary residence, and I want to be able to rent it out. I do not rent my house when I'm not there. It may be that I leave on the last day of a guest stay, but it's my house, and I'm not sure about that residency requirement, given that by all appearances, I'm traveling for work or traveling for vacation, and it's my primary residence, so I'm a little concerned about that. I will just reiterate that it seems guests do contribute to the larger economy. And my last note is my homeowners association, given that it's so small, four units, has already addressed this. And our homeowners association is allowing owner-occupied Airbnb rentals. And so I feel a little bit restricted in that, do I get to tell my neighbors, because I was first to market, that they can't rent theirs because my unit is one quarter of what's available? And I don't really think that's fair to my neighbors who are in similar circumstances. They have their own front door. And I have lots of problems as a resident of Portland about non-owner-occupied Airbnb stuff. It's a different question, but...
So are you telling us that you think we should take condos and take them out of the multifamily context and put them in the single family?
I'm saying it's a complex combination of situations. I don't know what the right situation is. If I lived in a condo building that had 500 and there was one main door, I think it's a very different issue than ones that have their own entrance, or somebody who mentioned he had a side entrance so that everybody else in his building wasn't experiencing everybody. So different.
And I think you make a very valid point, because in a sense, what a condo is a stacked group of single family homes that have a different legal relationship, and they have a shared interest in the shared spaces, and they have separate ownership of their spaces. So it is in fact like a hybrid. A cooperative apartment would, I think, more naturally fall within the multifamily. A condo does straddle both. So I think you're raising an interesting point for us to think about.
You're sort of a townhouse style, it sounds like, in terms of the architecture of the project.
Yeah, I'm not sure an exact definition of townhouse, but...
Separate entrances, I mean.
Yeah.
But even if it's not, the point is the ownership, right. And the condominium association would have the right to say, yes, everybody can do it, nobody can do it, 25% can do it. So I do think maybe we need to do something different for where all the units are owner-occupied. I'm not sure that having that even the 25% limitation makes any sense at all.
Well, there's a whole host of legal issues here, but I think that piece requires a little more thought.
Yeah.
Because it falls into both camps, and then there's some policy questions we have to make.
Makes sense.
Just to show that staying till the end of a 2.5-hour hearing can still introduce something that can catch our attention and be very helpful. Thank you very much.
Sure, thank you.
Thank you very much. Anyone else that wants to speak? Come on up, please.
Good afternoon. My name is Bryce Stevens. I've appeared before you before, but I own a property management company. We specialize in high-rise condominiums, and so I'll keep my comments brief. One, we wouldn't support the 25% amendment based on my interaction with owners through the years, and having been in 10 newly developed buildings in the last decade, I don't think you'd find that those owners would support that kind of cap. In fact, most owners in my experience, when we first go in, most of the documents require put a cap of 30% on rentals, and they're usually trying to figure out some way to get that down. So, and that's for long-term rentals. Second is, I agree with the previous comments about having the agent sign the document, not the property manager. That is the right terminology. I'm a little concerned about the property managers certifying the smoke detectors. I think that introduces some liability for us that I'm not sure our insurance would cover, or that we really want to take on. And if the best the city can do is a complaint-driven system, I'm not sure that we should be expected to do better. And then there was an amendment to remove the signing off of the Homeowners Association. I'm also not in favor of that. I think at a minimum they need to be notified that it's occurring, so that if they do have obligations under their documents, they can enforce them. A lot of times, and we've seen a rise in this recently, especially with Airbnb, is every week we find a unit for rent that's in violation of the governing documents, and then it creates a lot of unnecessary work, or as if we had a process where they had to notify us, it would be simpler. It is our plan. Once you guys all decide what to do, we're going to do an education program for all our residents because, and correct me if I'm wrong, but what I've heard today is that the association's governing documents will trump whatever is passed by the city here. That is the intent, correct?
Does now and will then.
Yeah, yes. Yeah. So I'm not so concerned about the specifics because almost all of the documents don't allow for this type of use in the buildings we manage, at least. And with that, that's my comments. Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks very much. Welcome.
Hi, my name is Brenda. Last name is Koo. I'm actually new to Airbnb. I'm a host, and I'm a long-term landlord, though. I rent out a furnished unit on a month-to-month basis. And similarly to the gentleman that just spoke, some of the questions about working with homeowners associations and et cetera has always kind of trumped use of Airbnb. However, I think that the owner occupancy rule is something that's quite interesting. I'm not quite understanding why it's such a big deal, whether we're owner occupancy at all. It's actually been a interesting use of the opportunity to potentially use Airbnb to fill in gaps in between leases. And potentially, you know, most the people who have been interested in using my condo have been on a monthly basis, but then there might be 5 days in between somebody starting that could be used by another Airbnb tenant or a guest per se. And as a non-owner occupant, I'm not sure why I wouldn't be able to utilize that and how that would affect affordable housing or not. I don't think it would. Now, granted, is my case different? Maybe. But whether there's a time frame that we start to look at, if we're going to regulate in general, maybe regulate, you know, nightly visits versus, you know, couple day stays or weekly or that type of thing, but why not permit me to be able to use the services if I'm not owner occupied?
Okay, thank you. Thanks very much for raising that. Thanks a lot. Okay, I think unless there's anyone else that wants to testify, yes, please come on up. And then after that, we'll bring staff back up and have some questions and next steps. Yes, either one. They both work.
Hi, my name is Tian Xu Dan. I actually have a similar situation as the lady before me. I own an apartment building that I have an apartment has separate entrances from the main units that I rent out month to month is furnished. And to be honest, I wouldn't feel so great if my tenants put their units on Airbnb and then I wouldn't know who's coming and going in my building. And I will feel so much better if, as the owner of the building, even though I'm not owner-occupied, I am in control of that. And I think if you're concerned about safety issues, that would be the safest thing to do. And also, you know, when you talk about smoke alarms and that, those are things that I, as an owner, I'm responsible for maintaining. And I think I do a much better job than my tenants, even though they're responsible for testing all the smoke alarms. I still go in there every year to test them myself because I just don't, you know, they're young. They're 20-somethings. They don't have their heads in that. So I'm just thinking maybe, you know, allowing the owners some control in that or giving them the opportunity or the licenses, you will have a... you would be able to regulate that better.
Yeah, okay.
Because we're already complying to, you know, to so many regulations already, we're good at it.
Yeah.
That's it.
Thank you. No, thanks very much. Okay, so I think we would like to have Jackie and Matthew and Sandra back up and perhaps have revenue on deck as well, but let's see what questions we have. And we heard some discussion and some suggestions about additional amendments. So any of us that have some guidance or requests about that, this would be a good time.
I have a requested amendment to my amendments, and that is to comport with Gwen Baldwin's suggestion on, I believe, both Amendment 3 and Amendment 4, to delete property manager and exchange that for authorized agent.
Second.
Okay. Does that make sense as a proposal? Okay, so let's take a roll call to change that language, and then we'll see how we're going to act on this.
Novick?
Aye.
Fritz?
And just to clarify, I think in my Amendment 4, where number 3, property owner, Do we need authorization in that one, Sandra, or is that the standalone?
It would be. They're cumulative. We weren't sure which ones were going to pass, so we had to separate them out.
Oh.
Yes.
Yes. Aye.
Fish?
Aye.
Hales?
Aye. Okay. So your recommendations about, we've had the amendments that we've put on the table, we can act on those today. We can continue the hearing and act on those when we come back. What do you recommend?
You're asking Senator Dingfelder?
Well, I'm asking staff and council members.
Could the city attorney ask a clarifying question on amendments just to make sure I understand? The amendment you just made was to remove authorized agents from three, but you also mentioned number four, and I don't see the term.
That's why I said or. So in number four, it's property owner or authorized.
You're going to add it. Okay, I just want to make sure I didn't catch that one. And does that mean also that Commissioner Fish's language in his amendment one, which references property manager, needs to be? I'm just asking staff, maybe.
That's true. So Commissioner Fish's amendment was to add that the building owner or property manager would do the self-certification. I think that would probably be now property owner or property or authorized agent. In this case, that's not codified language. We were just memorializing the council's intent in the code commentary, which is part of the staff report.
I think it would apply there as well, so I appreciate that clarification.
Thank you. Does that need to be an amendment?
So that needs to be
an amendment to Commissioner Fish's amendment.
So moved.
Second.
Okay. Further discussion on that change? Roll call on that change.
Novick?
Aye.
Fritz?
This has been a very good hearing. Thank you for bringing all these things to our attention. Aye.
Fish?
Aye.
Hales?
Aye.
And one more point of clarification. It seems like we have voted on 3, 4, and Commissioner Fish's. We have not voted on Amendment 1.
Yeah, we did.
Yeah, we did.
Mm-hmm. You voted to put it on the table for testimony. You didn't vote to amend the draft.
No, I understand that, but I'm going to suggest that at this point, having had a number of amendments and amendments to amendments, that we take a council motion to enroll all of those in the draft, and it comes back for second reading. And that way everybody can check and make sure that we got the language that we think we got, and that the community can do the same thing. So does that make sense that we adopt?
Always unroll the dice if we get it wrong.
Well, that's what we're trying to avoid.
We're doing an omnibus adoption now.
Yes, I'm not sure if it's possible to unroll the dice. That's why I want to make sure we get it right the first time. So I would entertain a motion to adopt all the amendments.
Second.
Further discussion on that. Does that make sense to you all? Mm-hmm. So that now we codify everything that we've done in terms of the testimony we heard and what we've changed today. That's what comes back for second reading, and both the council and interested citizens can see both. So
Correct.
Let's take a roll call on that.
Novick?
Aye.
Fritz?
Aye.
Fish?
Aye.
Hales?
Aye. Now, when will that be coming back? Is that not next
December
week?
December 3rd.
December 3rd? Is that what I thought?
Right. So then there's the question of, do we want to do something different for condos versus
apartments? Right. Which is a new, quote-unquote, new issue in that it came up clearly here in this discussion.
So this would be the only regulation in the zoning code where we would differentiate condos from other multi-dwelling buildings. So all the development standards, FAR, maximum number of density, parking requirements, setbacks, et cetera, all of that are the same for condos or multi-dwelling structures.
Can I make a suggestion? Because it's late in the day, and I'm loath to take this issue up out of context. And I'd like to know more about the context. Can we maintain what we have and then ask you to report options back to us and amend this at some later date if we think that there ought to be a change?
That would be a whole new legislative process. We'd have to take it back to Planning Commission.
We can introduce an ordinance. That's possible.
I guess I'd like to articulate better what the problem is with if this ordinance passes for at the second reading on December 3rd, and it applies both to apartments and condominiums. What is the issue that we're trying to resolve by differentiating between the two?
Well, we had a testimony that there might be a condominium association that would voluntarily choose to be above the 25% cap because it works differently for them in a small setting. And we've set a cap that says they can't. And one gentleman said, that he feels there's an unfairness of him being first to market and then his the other owners not being able to participate. And that
would apply to apartments. Now, why would that be?
Well, it's the analogy he was making. I'm mm-hmm. not going to make his argument for mm-hmm. him. Is that it's more like a collection of single family owners deciding to rent versus multifamily, and the different. I mean, I understand his point. I'm not prepared today to carve that out because I'd want to think about it. But a small condominium. And one thing we may want to do is think about whether there's a threshold in which condominiums of X or fewer units that wouldn't be subject to the cap.
What if
I think what Sandra's pointing out is that the zoning code doesn't differentiate whether right. it's owner-occupied right. or not.
And what if there are condominiums, but they all have renters in them?
Right. That's why I'm loath right. to take that
What's
up right
the
now.
Difference between that and multi-dwelling right. apartment?
My preference right. would be to take it up de novo at some future
yeah,
date.
Yeah, maybe it's part of the review or something.
Yeah, maybe it's part of the monitoring. We can take a look at, you know, how much is this happening in apartment buildings? How much is it happening in condominiums? How much in single dwelling? I think we'll have more information in 2 years.
And it's envisioned that BDS would be in charge of figuring out when we've got to the 25% cap, right, Mike?
Yes, we would be developing a robust tracking system for these applications, figuring out property types, structure types, number of units, determining the condo buildings and ownership structures would be a whole nother layer of that analysis that would be added on.
Oh, joy. I'm glad we're getting our fancy new computer.
One of the issues that came up tonight that at least is something I think we have to be aware of is how insurance law impacts what we're doing. Who is ultimately liable? Making sure that, the guest is covered under some policy. And just as we said we didn't want the fine to go against the property owner, I think we have to be careful here that a unauthorized guest doesn't end up creating an insurance liability for the owner, where the owner has prescribed the behavior and otherwise might have a claim against their insurance. And I don't know this area of the law, but did this come up in your deliberations, and do you have any thoughts for us about the liability insurance question?
Commissioner, this did come up in our deliberations, and I'm going to ask Mr. Liefeld if he can address the requirement.
I think it came up briefly, and I would again look to our city attorney, but BDS doesn't have an insurance requirement for any function for our administration of various codes. So permits that are pulled by contractors, owners, or tenants to do home occupations does not require an insurance disclaimer or proof of insurance to undo our burden in administering that permit.
Yeah, that's the trouble with this issue. We get right out to the edges of this issue, and that is we are amending the zoning code. We're not creating a short-term rental regulatory system. I mean, per se, we are amending the zoning code to say what is legally possible or not possible on that real estate that's zoned that way. Mm-hmm. And to some extent, we start to bend that instrument so far that it doesn't work very well, you know, at the edges of this issue. And I think this question of small condos where everybody that is as a unit owner is fine with more than 25%. And they all have separate entrances. And what's the problem here? I mean, that's right at the edges
yeah.
of that issue.
And I think condos the person who leaves the multifamily dwelling and gets in a cab, that cab has to have minimum levels of liability insurance, so the person knows they're protected if there's an accident. I don't know whether this is cured by having a disclaimer. I mean, most guests are assuming someone is covering their – there's liability insurance provided by someone. And it may be the answer is no one is.
And Commissioner, as Mike pointed out, under the existing code for home occupation, the city does not require insurance. So that's the continuation of, your short-term rental is a continuation of the home occupation statute, so to speak. So that would probably say you want to go back and revisit that entire strategy.
Jackie, what about the other question that came up consistently, though, about compelling the hosting platform to advertise the permit? Mm-hmm. Thomas Lanham said he's going to come back to mm-hmm. us shortly. I mean, why shouldn't we compel that? Is it within our power? And B, why shouldn't we require that? It seems like it's a very simple and elegant way to ensure compliance.
So I would say that the city attorney could probably answer the is it within our power? And on December 10th, Thomas and Bureau of Revenue will be coming back with some options that they're going to lay out for council for increased enforcement. But I would defer to city attorney of whether it's within our power.
And I'm not prepared to answer that today. That's certainly going to be part of the work that's being done with the Revenue Bureau. So,
why would we decouple it from this discussion? Because it we've heard from some people that this is the essence of the deal, that the regulatory side is the quid pro quo for allowing it. And this is, at least from my perspective, the cleanest tool for ensuring that you don't get to advertise your apartment if you don't have a permit number, and that's well within the authority of the hosting platform to request. In fact, it's already part of their field.
Yeah, Thomas may want to comment. My feeling is we're not decoupling this in terms of the council's intention. I think I read us correctly that we all want to energetically explore, if not adopt, that approach, but that's not necessarily going to get adopted in the zoning code.
Well, it's not in the zoning code, right? It's just like getting the taxes being paid was done before we did the zoning code stuff.
So that's a great answer, and I guess all I need to hear is that we're going to vigorously pursue that avenue, and that it's to come, and it is de facto considered part of the package. We just have to deal with it separately.
Yes.
That's what I.
Yeah.
So if we're all
sense.
In agreement on that,
yeah.
Thomas. Thank you.
I'm glad I was able to come up and.
Your number 12 bus is arriving in 3 minutes.
Your words were so good that it clarified the situation completely.
So thank you. But I think we did hear from a lot of people who felt that was the solution. Frankly, the only argument that I can envision from the hosting platform is that by putting the permit number, they somehow think they've relinquish proprietary information. I hope that's not the argument they advance.
I don't think so.
Yeah, that's not what we've heard, but certainly I think you're going to hear from revenue some options that I think will help.
Quick comment. Yes, ma'am.
I was just wondering, like, if Craigslist.
Right. Yeah, right. Good point.
For consistency, it would have to be on all the
yeah,
platforms.
Yeah, this is going to have to be consistently across all platforms. Right, exactly. So, again, what regulatory authority we have is limited, not terribly limited, but limited. And then where we put it in our own code is a choice as well. There's some stuff we're doing here in the zoning code, which I think we're close to agreement on. And then there are things that we have to do beyond that in other regulations that I think you've got a good strong sense of the council about what we want to see come back, whether it's December 10th or later on, 6 months from now, if we look back at this, take a deeper look at this small condo issue, you may come up with a solution.
One other issue for me is I just want to get clarity from you. What is it that we're going to evaluate in either 6 months or a year? So we're going to, assuming we adopt this, what's going to come back to council and what are we going to be evaluating?
So it was for September 2016, and that's what's in the ordinance, and we actually copied it into the ordinance for multi-dwelling, so we'll be doing all of it. So as far as we've heard a lot of ideas, I think, bantered around today, certainly from the permitting side, we'll be able to come back and say, it looks like this is how many are on these various platforms. It looks like this is how many permits we've received. This is inspections that we've conducted and ones that we've issued. I think one of the interesting things for us will be also what issues have come up in inspections. Are we seeing some trends in the inspections? Are there some problems, et cetera? Obviously, the situation of people aren't coming in for permits if they aren't at that time, which hopefully won't be the case. I'd love to talk to Oregon On and the Alliance of Tenants also of, like, how do we take a look at the affordability question that we're also curious about. The Bureau of Housing. We have a demographer in our bureau to talk to also about. You know, we've looked at the one study that we have seen so far. It came out of San Francisco, and of all their housing units, it's such a small percentage that they had a hard time concluding that there was causality between short-term rentals and affordability because there's so many other factors. You know, our complete neighborhoods, walkability, a new seasons goes into a neighborhood, et cetera. So we'll be exploring what exactly we can monitor what data we need to collect now and what we need to collect in 2 years if we need.
So what I would ask you to do is to touch base with the council offices on how we might construct that survey, because I think we're going to get some great recommendations from the advocacy community.
Mm-hmm.
I'd be very interested to know what the Housing Bureau thinks would be the right metric so we can agree on that mm-hmm. well in advance.
Yeah, and it would be great if we could get funds through the spring bump to get that going.
Susan, sorry.
She almost took the words. No, we just had this conversation, and I suggested that Sandra start putting together an outline of what would need to go into the report and who we'd have to confer with. Also, I know that Thomas will be making the rounds and visiting all the council offices to talk about the upcoming discussion on the
table. Jackie, if you just snuck it in your sidewalk budget and sort of disguised it, I think it'll get through us. Yeah.
Thank you for that suggestion.
Pad one of those lines.
So the ordinance as amended is going to come back in 2 weeks. Then correct. We're going to hear from the Revenue Bureau very shortly thereafter. I'm going to commit my staff to continued work with the stakeholders as well as with the Bureau on looking at these issues of research and follow-up. Obviously, by September of next year, we get a formal report, but we...
September 2016. It was 2 years
two years.
We wanted to take a look at it in 2 years.
I was going to say, I appreciate the good staff work that's being done, and I suspect that one of the reasons that Sandra knows that date so precisely is that she's already arranged to be away for a whole month in someplace like Istanbul, renting a room in somebody's apartment.
Yeah.
She's put a lot of work into this issue.
I also want to mention that... Commissioner Fritz and your staff have been amazingly helpful, and BDS will be a big component because this is, right now we're talking about the zoning code, and next we're moving into implementation and the enforcement stages. So we'll be working very closely with your staff.
And it's been particularly helpful to have development services staff involved, not only because they're spectacularly knowledgeable, mm-hmm. but in the past regulations have been put in place that are unenforceable and unimplementable, and we've, I think, avoided that. I do want to credit my chief of staff, Tom Bizzo, who's put in a lot of time on this. Thank you.
I don't want the last comment to be a negative one, but 2 years strikes me as a very long time with all the uncertainty here. And I know that we're talking about a comprehensive report.
Yeah.
But I wonder, Mayor, if we could get something on a more interim basis that gives us some data so we can figure out if we're still in the single digits, if there's other conspicuous things that mandated
agree.
So we get that data and can act on it earlier.
Yeah, I don't think we need to necessarily mess with the formal timeline that Susan mm-hmm. has. But I think at a staff and leadership level here, we ought to be getting more regular reports than that. And again, it's multiple bureaus. It's how it's working at BDS in terms of permitting. It's how it's working at revenue in terms of coordination. So I think we need to just find the ways and means to be back to the council with some kind of higher level of information in 6 months and see where we are in a year. And then we may still have this far horizon of September 2016, and that's fine. But I think that's too long as well. That's why I transposed it to next year, because that seemed like about the right length of time.
I think it's officially in the ordinance, but we can certainly see, having a more informal check-in.
Do you mind moving that up a year, or do you feel strong?
Well, I would think we could have – this is something we're not going to want to just be one and done. So I would say that we do want an interim report in September of 15, as well as the one that was in the previous ordinance.
That's
we could do that.
Quite doable. I think we can ask our bureaus and our staff to do that and maybe have to pay for it.
If we give you something in the winter bump.
We did bring that up.
That would be nice.
The right thing to do. Well, again, thank you all that have worked on this. Thank everyone from the community that have given us a lot of good guidance on this, and it'll pass the second reading in 2 weeks. Thank you all. We're adjourned. Hey, Steve. How are you? Good. Hey, Rachel, let me give you the load here. So what Thomas is coming up with is a way he may be able to explain it better than I can. Thanks, Nate. Thank you. It is for a way to better coordinate between the Revenue Bureau, which is, after all, receiving room tax revenue being collected by short-term rental services, Airbnb included, maybe limited to, but not permanently limited to.
Yeah, yeah.
And the Bureau of Development Services that's issuing these permits to people as they apply for them. So we have two different departments of city government that have different levels of information, and the plan is for them to share that data, right?
Yes.
So, so that will... on a property by property basis. And then the question is, what do we do with that? Do we send folks an email and say, just a friendly reminder, you need to get a permit, or do we become more, what's the word I'm looking for? Other